Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Anish Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the Breast Center at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Drs. Foss and Chagpar welcome Dr. James Yu. Dr. Yu is Assistant Professor of Therapeutic Radiology at Yale School of Medicine. Here's Francine Foss.
Can you start off a little bit by telling us about your background and how you came to the Yale Cancer Center, how long you've been here?
Sure. So I've actually been in New Haven on and off since the mid-90s because I went to college here. I went to medical school at the University of Michigan. Then I came back for radiation oncology residency training, and I never left. Right away, my practice has been treating folks with prostate cancer, with cancers of the genitourinary tract. And I also treat patients with brain tumors along with colleagues in neurosurgery, treat folks with brain metastases with our gamma knife.
So, Yale, why don't you tell us a little bit more about prostate cancer in particular, since that's an area of expertise for you, and a little bit more about the role that radiation plays in all of the different options that people have. I mean, you just mentioned gamma knife, and we hear about all of these newfangled technologies. Set the plate for us of what the options are for people and what role radiation plays in the treatment of prostate cancer.
Sure. Radiation is a local treatment, sort of like surgery in the sense that it treats an area of your body. But unlike surgery, there's no cutting, but it's also not as specific as surgery. So it's kind of in between a whole body treatment and a very specific treatment like surgery. Radiation is used to attempt to cure prostate cancer. Traditionally, it's been folks who are not eligible for surgery because they're of advanced age and not likely to tolerate surgery as well. But radiation is also used in combination with androgen deprivation therapy, otherwise known as pulling away the testosterone of a patient in higher risk disease. So those are kind of the two main areas where radiation has been traditionally used: folks who are older who can't tolerate surgery, or folks who have disease that may be outside of the prostate. So removing the prostate may not be as helpful as treating a region of your body.
You mentioned older people. Can you tell us the average age of a patient with prostate cancer? And also, can you tell us, is that changing?
Sure. So the average age of a patient who has prostate cancer is roughly 65 or 66, and that's in the current era. And I'll foreshadow our discussion about screening. But in the current era, in the current screening climate, men in their mid-60s are the most common age at diagnosis. But because prostate cancer is so common and so prevalent, I'm sure if you looked hard enough, you could find prostate cancer at an even earlier age than we currently do. And if we don't screen as much, I'm sure that age at which folks are diagnosed will get older.
So I want to get to the screening issue in just a second, but tell us a little bit more about radiation, because some of us think of radiation as, you know, sitting outside in the sun and getting radiation, and that's one form of radiation. But then, you know, you hear about all of these newfangled technologies, and you wonder, is this all the same stuff? Are they different? Which one's the best? Can you give us some insight into this? Because, you know, people hear about all of these new technologies, and I don't know about the rest of the world, but I'm still a little unclear on what all of these things are.
So at the core, therapeutic radiation is the breaking of a cancer cell's DNA with a particle, either a photon or a proton or an electron or certain places in the country, a neutron or a carbon ion. Regardless, it's a beam of energy that what you're trying to do is to break the DNA of a cancer cell so that the next time it tries to divide, it can't. That's the primary way that radiation kills cancer. 99% of beam radiation is delivered with photons, megavolted photons with machines called linear accelerators. That's the way it's done throughout the country. At a few select places around the country, there are huge proton machines that can beam high-energy protons at the prostate in an attempt to kill the cancer. And then beyond that, there's brachytherapy, which is also very commonly done, where radioactive seeds are inserted inside the prostate itself. Now, the photons that are emitted from the radioactive sources are much lower energy than the beamed-in radiation, so it doesn't go... The energy deposition is more localized to the prostate, but the goal is the same, to break the DNA of a cancer cell. And then there's... We could go on and on. There's variations on the theme.
Does the prostate particularly lend itself to radiation therapy because of the location, or are there, you know, good things or bad things about radiating in the prostate?
Well, I think radiation has been popularized for prostate cancer because you don't have to cut the connection between the bladder and the urethra. You don't have to cut through tissue to get there, but radiation itself can cause local side effects to the urethra, which travels through the prostate, or to the rectum immediately behind it, or the bladder immediately above it. But you know, compared to other places in your body, it's both a location that you have to be very careful about, but it's also not in your brain, for example. So there are no long-term neurologic side effects with radiating the prostate. And it's not near your heart, so you're not going to, you know, die of a heart attack because you had your prostate radiated. So it's both a good and bad place to get radiation.
So, James, I can imagine that there may be some men out there who have just been diagnosed with prostate cancer because, as you say, with the era that we're in now where so many men get screened and so many people get diagnosed with prostate cancer, I would bet you that there are people out there who are wondering, yeah, okay, so he's talking about photons and then he's talking about protons and then he's talking about this brachytherapy stuff. What people really want to know is which one's the best.
Right. Right. So if someone asks me which one's the best, the answer always is it depends. It depends on what your own personal values are, how far you want to travel, how much you want to spend, for example, how convenient you want the treatment to be, what side effects you're most worried about. And helping patients choose, helping patients make a decision about what treatment to get is an intense area of study. There are a lot of people out there who are trying to build these decision tools. I meet with a wonderful group of men who were trying to kind of ask the questions that prostate cancer patients are asking. And one of those things we're trying to do is to develop a tool that can help folks kind of match the treatment that's best to them. Because if you ask a physician what's the best treatment, there's no study that's definitively said treatment A is better than treatment B is better than treatment C. It really depends on who you ask. Sadly, sometimes it depends on how much the physician is invested in that piece of equipment, too.
So that brings us back to, I guess, a very fundamental question. A man is diagnosed with prostate cancer. What are the next steps, and do all men with prostate cancer see a radiation therapist? Can you just step us through the whole process from the time of diagnosis?
Sure. So currently in this day and age, the most common way that someone is diagnosed is through screening. So they're usually relatively asymptomatic. Their primary care provider, or if they have a urologist for another reason, checks their PSA or their prostate-specific antigen, which is a routine blood test. Then the urologist biopsies the prostate, and then that's when you have a diagnosis of prostate cancer. At that point, studies have shown that the urologist is the primary determinant of whether the patient then goes on to get what type of treatment. In an ideal world, though, they would have a conversation with a radiation oncologist or two, have a conversation with a urologist or two, and really take their time thinking about the options. My group of men who have informed me about what they like in terms of decision help also point to online forums of other prostate cancer patients as being very helpful, reaching out to friends and family who have had prostate cancer, really just getting comfortable with a treatment is the best.
You talked about time, and a lot of cancer patients think, oh, I don't have a lot of time. I have to make a decision very quickly about this. Can you talk about the time issue with prostate cancer? How much time do you have to make these decisions?
So prostate cancer patients, the vast majority of them can take months to decide on a treatment, particularly the low-risk prostate cancers where the Gleason score is 6 or their PSA is changing very, very slowly and it's been watched for years. Those folks can take a tremendous, not tremendous, but they can take a long time to think about their options, really discuss it with their friends and family, go online. We've found that Wikipedia is actually the most reliable, one of the more reliable sources of information, believe it or not, rather than the industry websites. And even, sadly, some academic websites that have their own investment in machinery. Really, the American Cancer Society, Wikipedia, those types of things are very helpful.
So Wikipedia for medical information.
Believe it or not, it's very good.
So, James, that brings us back to the whole screening topic because, as you point out, a lot of people now are getting diagnosed at a really early stage. And in general, we say that's great, right? The earlier you're diagnosed, the more treatable cancers are. And so the more time you have to think about what you want to do. But recently, the screening recommendations for prostate cancer have changed. And I think that this has caused some men, perhaps, a fair amount of angst. Because now, if I understand it correctly, recommendations are that you don't need to get screened right. quite as much as we had previously advocated. Can you speak to that?
Sure. So the big controversy was put out there by the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force that basically came out and said that you don't need to routinely screen men for prostate cancer. Now, that's a group of physicians that have come and looked at all the data. But there was not a urologist or a radiation oncologist or a medical oncologist involved in that study group, as far as I could tell. And then competing guidelines came out from the American Urologic Association, the American Society of Clinical Oncology, which said, yes, you do need to screen, but you don't have to screen as often as we used to. Every two-year screening is fine. And folks, before they get screened, should have a conversation with their physician about what they will do should there be a prostate cancer diagnosis. And also, it should be men over the age of 55 and under the age of roughly 70 to 75 with good health who are expected to live 10 to 15 years. And so will benefit from a small decrease in the likelihood of dying from prostate cancer. If you're in your 80s and you're smoking 8 packs of cigarettes an hour, you know, and you're not in the greatest health, prostate cancer screening is likely to cause more harm than good. If you're in your early 60s, you're a marathon runner, you have a father who died of prostate cancer early, then yeah, maybe you should get screened. Maybe you should have a conversation with your primary care provider and talk about the implications of prostate cancer, the types of prostate cancer. I think it really should be individualized, and that's what our society is recommending.
Okay, so on that note, we're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more information about screening options for prostate cancer with our guest, Dr. James Yu.
The American Cancer Society estimates that over 1,000 patients will be diagnosed with melanoma in Connecticut each year. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. Early detection is the key. When detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable, and new treatment options and surgical techniques are giving melanoma survivors more hope than they've ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. The Specialized Programs of Research Excellence in Skin Cancer Grant at Yale, also known as the SPOR Grant, will help establish national guidelines on modifying behavior and on prevention, as well as identification of new drug targets. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Anise Chagpar, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Dr. Francine Foss. Our guest tonight is Dr. James Yu, and we are discussing screening for prostate cancer. So, James, right before the break, you had told us that there were two sets of competing guidelines, one that came out from the USPSTF and one that came out from the AUA and ASCO. Both seemed to recommend against doing prostate screening as frequently as we had done it before, some advocating even less than that. Can you talk about what now are the accepted guidelines? What should men who are listening to this program be thinking about in terms of screening? And what were the motivating factors for those changes in screening recommendations? Some argue that it was all cost-driven, and that really it wasn't quality-driven. Can you speak to that as well?
Sure. So the screening guidelines were driven by the fact that there isn't strong randomized trial evidence supporting screening as lengthening men's lives on a routine basis. There were two major huge screening trials that came out a couple of years ago, one in the United States and one from Europe. The United States trial, the PLCO, prostate, lung, colon, ovarian group, basically found no survival benefit to folks who were recommended routine screening compared to best practice. And I don't think the audience can see me waving my fingers in terms of the quote sign. But best practice in the United States, though, at the time was screening. So the trial was flawed to begin with because a lot of folks in the screening arm obviously got screened, but also a lot of folks in the best practice arm got screening. So, it was kind of a given that there wouldn't be a big survival difference between the two arms. In Europe, though, they did the same trial, the ERSPC randomized trial, and they did find a benefit to prostate cancer screening, but it was small. And because of that, the USPSTF, or the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, said, you know what, the evidence is pretty modest. There are a lot of side effects associated with treatment. Because of that, we don't think screening routinely makes a lot of sense. Those of us who treat prostate cancer would take a step back and say, yes, screening does make sense, but screening in moderation and screening with eyes wide open and having a discussion with a patient about what it means should they want screening and what it means to be diagnosed with a cancer that is very unlikely to cause their death. Now, prostate cancer is a very expensive cancer for the United States as a whole. You know, 1 in 6 men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer during their lifetime. Each year, about almost 250,000 men are diagnosed with prostate cancer. So as a burden on the U.S. healthcare system, it's huge. It's about, the second leading cause of cancer death in American men. So anytime you talk about prostate cancer, you have to think about it from a national standpoint also, and what it means to treat, you know, 250,000 men every year and pay for their side effects and pay for all of the things that happen to them with only a modest benefit in survival.
So you talked about 1 in 6, is that correct?
Yep.
1 in 6 men. Is that 1 in 6 men that are screened, or is that 1 in 6 in the population?
Right. That's in their lifetime, 1 in 6 men. And honestly, as you get older and older, if you screen, you know, there are some studies of, for example, Japanese men in their 90s, who at the time of autopsy, almost 80 to 90% of those men had prostate cancer in their prostate. So if you screen intensely enough in the oldest men, you're going to find prostate cancer.
We talk about screening costing money, and you've alluded to the PSA, but can you tell us what the whole screening process is? Are there things that are done other than the PSA?
Sure. So after the blood test, if you have an elevated PSA, which Again, there's a lot of studies looking at what's the ideal cutoff, but routinely the cutoff of 4 is used. If your PSA is above 4.0, you get a prostate biopsy. A prostate biopsy is done by inserting long needles into your prostate. Typically, 12 cores are obtained by the urologist. Those cores are sent off to a pathologist, and they examine them under the microscope for evidence of cancer.
So, James, I want to get back to talking about cost, because I know, and maybe our audience doesn't know, but one of James's fortes is actually in health services research, and you've done a great deal of work looking at cost and quality and so on. And I think that that's particularly relevant in today's era, and we're thinking about the Affordable Care Act and the sequester and the deficit and everything else. Can you speak a little bit more about the balance between the cost of screening and the cost of treatment? Because I'm sure that the men out there who are thinking about, you know, healthcare costs are thinking, well, it's fine to save on other people's healthcare costs, but when I get my cancer, by golly, I want the Rolls Royce.
Right. Well, the cost of prostate cancer treatment is enormous, and different treatments cost more than others. Radiotherapy, particularly a technique called intensity modulated radiation therapy, which is the type of therapy that I apply to men, is particularly expensive. And then beyond that, proton radiation, which is delivered by these $100, $150 million machines, is even more expensive. So at a certain point, I think both Medicare and the insurers are going to stop paying for these treatments without evidence of efficacy. And that's part of the research that we do. And there are many studies out there trying to compare the impact of the treatments on men's lives, the efficacy of those treatments, and the cost of those treatments. But honestly, complex decision analysis can't take into account an individual patient's preference. So yes, those studies are interesting from a macroscopic standpoint, and I participate in those studies too, but ultimately it just goes back to a closed door with the physician and the patient talking over the options.
When you talk about the decision being made based on efficacy, can you clarify for the audience, are we talking about a patient responding to the treatment? Are we talking about a patient living longer? Are we talking about an improvement in quality of life? So what is the actual measure that's going to help them to determine whether they should continue paying for this?
Right. So in health economics, people use a term called a quality-adjusted life year, which is a combination of how long folks live, but also the quality at which they're living. When people do cost-effectiveness analyses, they try and calculate that for a treatment. So if you have a treatment that you live 100 extra years, but you're living with terrible side effects, that may not be as good as a treatment where you live 90 years, but have no side effects whatsoever. So a quality-adjusted life year is the typical measure.
And can you put into context for us when we're talking about cost and quality? You know, a lot of people sit there and think, well, maybe the cost of treatment will actually be lower if we detect this early, mm-hmm. and therefore the cost of screening may be worth it. Certainly in some cancers, like breast cancer, for example, that applies. How is that in prostate cancer?
Well, so people haven't really looked at the cost of screening per se, although our research group, the Cancer Outcomes and Public
Policy
and Effectiveness Research, of which you're a member.
I am.
We're looking at the cost of cancer screening, but it's very difficult to separate right now from just the lab test, just the biopsy, because there's more costs than that. There's the psychological costs. There's the impact of lost days of work if you're worrying, et cetera. But I think early indications are it's not really the cost of the screening. It's what you do with that screening that really costs a lot more.
So, James, should most men in the audience be thinking, when they're thinking about prostate cancer and they're thinking about treatment, should they be thinking that this treatment is going to cure them and prolong their life? And should they be worried that, say, if they decide not to get treatment, that their life will be shortened from this cancer?
Right. So I think it depends on how aggressive their prostate cancer is. But certainly if they have a favorable risk prostate cancer, meaning their Gleason score is 6 or less, their PSA is less than 10, none of their physicians can feel a big tumor in their prostate. If those three things are true, then it is extremely unlikely that that cancer will cause the patient to die. They should have their, they could have their PSA followed over time under a technique called active surveillance, where they get a PSA very regularly, and also a biopsy every 1 to 2 years to make sure that the cancer doesn't change. That's a very reasonable way to go. Now, the caveat, though, is there are men out there who, no matter how much you reassure them that they just have a favorable risk prostate cancer, that knowledge impacts their quality of life, and it's extremely anxiety-inducing. Those folks, despite their favorable risk, despite the fact that the cancer is not going to kill them, they may benefit from treatment, at least just to get the cancer off of their minds. As silly as that sounds, it really is a patient-to-patient discussion.
Yeah, well, it's the big C word, and that's
right.
Scary for a lot of patients. But I think that the thing that those patients should think about as well is the balance between, is this treatment going to save my life,
mm-hmm.
and all of the side effects. So, James, can you talk a little bit about the side effects
sure.
of surgery, the side effects of radiation, and what people who pursue aggressive treatment may have to look forward to?
Absolutely. So both surgery and radiation can cause erectile dysfunction, significant erectile dysfunction. So, the number I quote to men is roughly 40% of men,
wow.
regardless of the treatment they get, are not going to be happy with their erections after the treatment. With surgery, that impact is right away, and then there's some recovery. With radiation, it's an accelerated but over time erectile dysfunction. In the end, it's the same. Those studies comparing the two groups are very difficult to do because surgery patients are younger, usually more potent. But study after study has shown they're roughly the same. So erectile dysfunction is the most common one. Surgery can cause urinary incontinence. Usually it's a little bit of dribbling, stress incontinence, coughing, lifting heavy objects, a little leakage. Sometimes it's much worse than that, but rarely. There are usually no rectal side effects associated with surgery. For radiation, though, the side effects are short-term and long-term. In the short-term, they typically have increased urination, increased urgency of urination, increased frequency of urination, very rarely requiring a catheter because the prostate has swollen to the point where men can't urinate. But usually over time, after about a year to 2 years, they come back to where they were before the radiation started. More common in radiation than in surgery are the rectal side effects. Rectal bleeding is a rare but real side effect from radiotherapy. Some men do report increased urgency and frequency of bowel movements. Very rarely there's fecal leakage that can happen after radiation, typically years after radiation. So it's a mixed bag of side effects. And again, it points to the individuality of making a choice. If men are extremely worried about their sexual function, then they should get active surveillance for as long as possible.
Dr. James Yu is Assistant Professor of Therapeutic Radiology at Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.